Karikaturista a umělec pan Gerald Scarfe je hostem radiožurnálu. It's great to have a chance to talk with you. Welcome.
I'm very pleased to be here.
Did you already make a cartoon of a royal baby, or it's still too early?
Well, it's still too early. I mean, all babies look the same, don't they? But I probably will make a caricature. Well, if I live long enough, I might make a caricature. But I think the interesting thing about this baby is that if it had been a girl, we would have had to change the rules in Britain to make a first-born girl the Queen of England. My wife was telling me that she's very keen, of course. She's not a feminist, but she is a woman, and she was very keen that a woman would have equal rights, as am I, to the kingdom of the throne of the kingdom. So it's a shame in a way that it's a boy, because if the girl had been born, we would have had to, you know, automatically accept a woman, which I think is right.
I thought you already did, because, you know, if you're doing what you're doing, you can actually break any rules, because, of course, all the babies look the same, but you can, you know, be the first one to arrive with a picture of a royal baby, which is not a bad choice.
I could do, you know, but caricature is a very cruel art, and I think it would be a terrible way to depict a baby on their first arrival in the world, you know, to have... They have to do all the royal photographic pictures first, I think, before I get stuck into it.
How would you define yourself? Artist, cartoonist, man who's been drawing over 44 years for Sunday Times?
Well, the one term that fits all is artist, really, because it is a very difficult job being an artist. You know, people don't really need artists. They need, you know, useful people like bakers or nurses or doctors.
Excuse me, have you ever felt sorry that you're not useful in this kind of term?
Well, I would like to be useful in those kind of terms, but I feel I'm kind of useful in, you know, in the job that I do, in being able to say what I want to about the world around me in through the Sunday Times newspaper in Britain and so on. But, I mean, the reason I do so many things, I think, is because it is difficult being an artist. And you have to diversify. And I've gone into animation and rock and roll and theater, opera, ballet. I design cartoons. I just try everything I can. I mean, it's pretty dull drawing politicians all the time. They are such a dull mob.
That's what I was about to ask. If it's not boring to, you know, do the paintings such a long time, 44 years.
It is, but I mean, I work on the Sunday Times, which is once a week, you know, that's all. The rest of the week I do all sorts of other things. But yes, it is extremely boring to draw these arrogant fools who think that they know the way we should lead our lives.
Haven't you ever met any exception?
Yeah, of course, you know, and when Obama was first elected, I had great hope. I mean, the fact that he was an African-American and there were so many people against the African-Americans in America, and yet despite that, you know, his liberalism and all that got through and he was elected. So I do have heroes, but not a lot. Not a lot. I mean, most politicians, I feel, are out for themselves. They're out for their own glory. That's not entirely true for all of them, of course. Some of them, I think, start with the best of intentions, but then as time goes on, they find themselves knocked sideways this way and that way by big business, by different interests, power struggles around the world, dealing with foreign dictators. And so it's pretty difficult, even for Obama now. I started
Have you lost his feeling? Your feeling for Obama?
No, I haven't. No, I still like him and I still like his atmosphere. But I drew him when he first arrived as Superman because, you know, everybody expected so much of him. As a president, he was supposed to put this right, that right. Of course, as I say, when he came up against the reality of the job, then he found it difficult to put into operation. And I now draw him still as Superman, but his cloak is torn and his trousers are patched and so forth because, you know, there's a money problem, there's everything problem everywhere.
So the politician or the subject has to develop, and as he develops, your caricature develops as well.
Yes, very much so.
Can you give me some examples?
Mm.
Not Obama.
Not Obama, no. I mean, the character, first of all, the caricature must come from the character. In Britain, we had Mrs. Thatcher. Now, I wasn't a fan of Mrs. Thatcher. She seemed to have a rather cold heart towards those people who couldn't look after themselves. But I have to admit, she was an incredibly strong woman, and extra strong in order to be able not only to be prime minister, but to beat the men. You know, she had to be twice what the men were. And so whenever I drew Mrs. Thatcher, she always produced a good drawing because she was strong. We've had some very weak prime ministers, and when I draw them, there's nothing really to get hold of, nothing to comment on. But Mrs. Thatcher, I could always draw her something cutting like a knife or an axe cutting off the head of the unemployed, or I could draw her as a Tory dactyl. I'd always like a pterodactyl.
With a very pointy nose.
With a very pointy nose, yes. And she didn't, of course, have a very pointy nose, but that's what cartoonists do. They give people a certain look, and it sticks like that. And the public recognize if that person with a pointy nose is in the paper, that must be Mrs. Thatcher.
If I would be a cartoonist, I would probably be very keen to see how the politician sees his own cartoon for the first time.
Well, I think the terrible truth of it is that, you know, cartoons help the politician sometimes. They're almost pleased at first to be caricatured and cartooned because it means they're a person of note. It means they're a person who's arrived, person who's recognizable. And it adds to their aura, adds to their... And they all say, oh, we can take it, you know. And they make a joke of it and so forth. I can see it must be irritating when they've been in power for some time and they are at the top of the tree and every day. But I don't think they pay much attention to all of that, you know. And I'm not sure people pay much attention to cartoons anyway. I think the cartoon is a simple point made in the newspaper, which a lot of people can say, oh, that's what I thought. That's the way I felt. And this guy has put it into visual form. But I don't think, you know, that it changes anything. I think that newspapers can change things. For instance, during the time of Richard Nixon, I bashed Richard Nixon. I didn't like Richard Nixon. I drew Richard Nixon over and over again in a bad light. But it wasn't me that brought him down. But it was the Washington Post who brought him down because of Watergate, you know. And so the newspapers do have the power. But I think that cartoonists are considered as weirdos, mavericks, you know, people who would say that, you know, and do little jokes in newspapers. So I don't feel as though there's any power there. But I still have to keep doing it. You never know.
Talking about those two big names, Richard Nixon and Margaret Thatcher, do you distinguish between those politicians who are British, because you're British yourself, and the others who are not yours? Let's put it that way.
Not really, no, because they're all operating in the same sort of areas. They're all in power and visiting their ideas upon the people, and so often those ideas are wrong, they make mistakes. They're all fallible, like we're all fallible.
Yeah, I know, but if it's a British politician, you know, he may impact you as a politician, because you're a...
Do you mean am I more ferocious with the British?
Yeah.
I don't think so, no. I mean, I'm pretty ferocious about what's going on all around the world, really. And, you know, in a way, to a certain extent, our domestic politics in Britain is quite calm compared with some of the other parts of the world. So I do hit either left or right or middle. It depends on what that politician is doing. I'm not necessarily a socialist or, you know, a capitalist or anything. I try and keep an open view and attack each issue in its own right.
Coming back to Margaret Thatcher, when she died, you released, or Sunday Times released your caricature 1 week after the funeral. It became very popular, but still, painting things like this in a very fragile times, did you have any kind of censorship?
No. I mean, the Sunday Times has been pretty good to me about, you know, politically I'm never censored. Obviously, if I drew something sexually overt, you know, that they wouldn't publish that because they're what they call a family newspaper. I think I can pretty well draw what I want to. I mean, the year before last, I had an exhibition in Germany, and a lot of the German artists, cartoonists who came to the opening said to me, We couldn't do this in our country. You know, this is Germany, which is a very, very open country.
Excuse me, did they see Angela Merkel breastfeeding those?
No, I hadn't done it at that point. But, oh. You know, there was a big you know, what? I showed Angela Merkel breastfeeding Italy and Greece. And with Spain standing by, you know, because they are milking Germany in a way. But some feminist MPs, members of parliament, wrote this letter to the Sunday Times saying how awful it was to show a woman breastfeeding. What's wrong with breastfeeding? I mean, I don't get it. I didn't understand what they're talking about. And they said, you know, you wouldn't do this to a man. Well, I mean, I do. I do it much more frequently to men because men are, in general, there are more men in power than there are women in power. So it happens more often that I attack men. But that sort of thing, Angela, I like drawing Angela Merkel. She's another very strong woman, amazingly strong woman, you know, who's done it against the odds, you know.
If somebody says your drawings are cruel.
Yeah, well, they
far
are.
Far too cruel.
Too cruel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm kind of pleased in a way because it means that I've hit the nail, I've hit the target, I hope. It means, one of the things one fears as one gets older is that you've got more benign or become more complacent or become more... So I'm still quite pleased when people say at my age, you know, you're just as cruel as you ever were. I think, first of all, as I said, caricature is a cruel art. If you take someone's nose and you just put 1 inch on the end of it, they don't like it. But if you like me, you put a meter on the end of the nose, you know, they dislike it even more. So we were saying it's boring drawing politicians, and one of the things I do to please myself is to distort them as much as possible and yet still keep a likeness. I still like to, you know, pull them apart as much as possible and yet still keep a likeness. And the only way I can think of describing is like a piece of chewing gum.
Yeah.
When you pull chewing gum, it stretches, and suddenly it goes. Well, it's the same with a likeness, you know. You can distort to a certain extent until it becomes unrecognizable and pointless. And getting a caricature is a very difficult thing in a way, really. I don't know what it's kind of like. It's not only a big nose or big ears. It's an ambience about the person, their feeling, their kind of... And I don't like to meet my victims or whatever you call them, but I like to observe them because... It's not only the way their face is, but it's the way their whole body is and the way they gesticulate or they walk or they stand at the bar and drink. Or it's all of those little things which add up to the caricature, really, which makes it ring true. So it is extremely difficult. And sometimes I make a drawing of someone and I think, that's it. I've got him or her. Perfect. Then I decide to either go and make a cup of tea or I go to the lavatory or something. And when I come back, it doesn't look like them anymore. They've changed. You know, the damn thing is gone. So it's really very frustrating in that way. So it's very, very tenuous getting a likeness.
Had any of your publishers had to apologize for any of your caricatures in past?
Not that I can think of. I mean, it's on my behalf, you mean. Well, I mean, Rupert Murdoch apologized for a cartoon I did of Netanyahu. I mean, I guess he's my publisher. But other areas, I don't know. For instance, the Angela Merkel cartoon, they just printed the angry letters, and then they printed a lot of supporting letters as well to balance it up. You know, and so I... But in general, I'm kind of on my own, really. I just, you know, fight my own battle.
Well, I don't think it's only yourself fighting the same battle. And thanks God, it is so. But what do you think about the Danish caricature of...
Do you know, I never saw it. I know it was online.
You didn't?
No, I didn't see it, but I heard about it.
Right.
And it's the sort of area I wouldn't... I don't attack people for their sexuality, whether they're gay or whatever. It doesn't make any difference to me. And I don't attack people for their religion. I'm not religious at all. You know, I'm not a believer. So it's all nonsense to me. You know, it's all fairy stories. But if people want to believe that, that's fine with me. I don't care. You know, as long as it makes them happy, I don't want to change their view of anything or not at all. So it's a sort of area I wouldn't go into, and so therefore I haven't really come across that problem.
So these are the only boundaries, right?
I'm sure there are others, but I can't think. You know, I wouldn't make a drawing of paedophilia. You know, uncomfortable.
I think yeah. I got it. Yeah,
you got it,
Mr. Scarf. Let's go back in past. You started working at advertising, as I understood. How do you recall this period of your life?
Well, to start even before that, I was born a chronic asthmatic child. I was a very, very bedridden, hospital-ridden child. I was frequently in hospital all the way through until I was about 10 to 12 in that area. And the drugs in those days were not sophisticated, so I suffered a lot, you know. And all I could do in my sick bed was to read and to draw. And drawing became my way, I think, of putting down my thoughts about the world, anticipating or explaining to myself what I felt was wrong with the, you know, he might have been a witch or something in the early days, you know, and I had to draw a witch to exorcise that from my yeah. from my consciousness. So as I grew up, I had very little education, and my father, who was in banking, wanted me to go into banks. It's like the other end of the spectrum to me, banking.
Banksters.
Well, yes. And the interesting thing is that my father said to me, you know, you don't want to be an artist. You know, you can do your art. You can do your art at home if you want to or whatever, but, you know, a real job is, you know, being in a bank, you'll be sure of some money, you'll be sure of a future and all those things that fathers say. And he said, you know, art is a very dodgy job, because dodgy was uncertain, you know, very kind of, you know. And now, if he were alive, I would say, well, you know, who's got the dodgy job now? It's the bankers, really. I mean, dodgy in Britain means also, you know, a bit sort of dodgy means not strictly above board. It means, you know, you're up to something on like bankers are. Anyway, so I to cut a long story short, I went to an advertising agency and I had to draw everything, you know, that was possible to put into a catalogue. It could be a chair, it could be a glass, it could be a table, it could be a bicycle, it could be anything that they were trying to sell. But the bit I didn't like about it was I had to make it look luxurious, glossy, fabulous, to make people buy it. And this is before the days of photography.
Oh, how do you feel about, you know, it now?
Well, advertising has always been lies. You know, we know that. You know, they're all lying all the time, telling you their product is the best. And
you just didn't want to be part of it, right?
I didn't want to be part of that. And my only way out was to become a cartoonist. And then in that way, I overreacted. There was a satirical magazine in Britain called Private Eye, and I joined that. And there I was encouraged to tell what I felt about things, you know. And that was really the other end of where I had been, where I was presenting a glossy picture of the world to what I thought was a real, truthful picture. My truth, obviously. Who knows what the truth is, but my truth. And that tended to be, you know, making things look pretty grotesque and horrible and awful. And I was, you know, called Hieronymus Bosch and all these other things at that time, because I drew in a very, very precise, grotesque style, I suppose, and I drew everything, you know, pimples and warts and pubic hair or nipples or whatever I drew. I didn't have any barriers.
How did your drawing change after you've been to Vietnam? Because I understood that that must be a really horrible experience. Besides, I don't understand why do they send a guy who is drawing to Vietnam when they had TV crews, when they had photographers?
Well, there are several reasons. I'll try and be as quick as I can. One is that I was drawing in a satirical magazine and I became extremely kind of well-known in Britain. I had a lot of TV, a lot of press, and I became notorious for doing these grotesque drawings. And then one of the national newspapers wanted to buy me, the Daily Mail, and then the Daily Express also entered into this trying to buy me. And they were both, you know, trying to get me because I was well known. They wanted me for the name. I eventually joined the Daily Mail, But they didn't want what I did. They didn't want the satirical drawings I'd been doing in Private Eye, where I could say what I wanted to, because this was a national newspaper, and I couldn't make the same drawings. So I thought, what can we do with this grotesque guy? Let's send him to a grotesque situation. And very soon after I joined the paper, they flew me to Vietnam, where I had to make drawings. The other thought is that, you know, there has been a tradition in newspapers of illustrations. Back in the time before photography, they used to send artists to the Boer War or somewhere, you know, wars in Africa or world, and they would make sketches, which were sent back to London. And in London, there were artists who sat at desks and transcribed these into engravings or so forth. And they take the sketches and they put one sketch, and they'd make it all part of the same. So they'd draw a sort of battle with the African natives or something like that, with the English firing guns, and that was that. That was reportage. So, you know, and I respected that. So I tried my best when I was there. But the awful thing about Vietnam, up until the point that I'd been there, it was to me just a name or something in a newspaper. And then whenever you watch TV in those days, it was kind of U.S. Marines jumping out of helicopters with the rotor blades going round and the grass fanning out. It all looked very gung-ho and John Wayne-ish and kind of like real, you know, tough movie stuff.
Good propaganda.
Propaganda, yeah, exactly. And because when you go there, it's chaos. It's absolute chaos. I mean, most of the soldiers there are 19, 20, college kids. They're pulled out of their studies, flown to the other side of the world, stuck in the jungle, and they're told to kill these people, you know, and they don't know who these people are, anything, or what they're doing. And I met some very sad boys there. One boy I drew on his bunk, and he'd been in a platoon that had gone out into the jungle, and they had been surrounded by the Viet Cong, which were the Vietnamese enemy of the Americans, and they had radioed to their strike aircraft to come in and napalm, but they told them the circle. They were in this circle, and they told them to strike outside the circle. And the pilot came in, he got it wrong, and he struck inside the circle and blew away. It's what they call friendly fire, you know, hit by your own side. And they'd blown away most of this guy's platoon. And this boy that I was drawing and talking to, he'd come from, I don't know, Middle West America, never seen anything of the world at all. Completely confused. His buddy had been blown up next to him with this napalm stuff, and he'd survived. He'd sort of stumbled out of the jungle like 3 days later. I mean, no wonder they go crazy, the guys, or commit suicide or whatever afterwards. So I found it a very, very tough environment to draw in. I found myself in many ways drawing the gentleness of the people. I mean, the Vietnamese people are the gentlest people in the world. They are the girls are beautiful, the men are beautiful, and they're very kind. Girls wore these wonderful chom sai, or whatever, I don't know what it's called, but it's a long, flowing white dress with white trousers underneath, and they look very, very beautiful. And they were just nice people.
Excuse me, did you arrive to a certain point where you said, I cannot paint this, because it's too much, it's too cruel, I cannot go anymore?
I did. I arrived at that point. I just couldn't do it. And I always prided myself as an artist, you know. I mean, at one point I said I wanted to go into the morgue in Vietnam, in Saigon Airport, and draw there. And the sergeant, you know, said, are you sure you want to do this? I said, yeah, I'm an artist. I draw anything, you know. And I went in there. I couldn't handle it because it was like, you know, I'd always assumed that when people shot, they'd fallen over like John Wayne in One Piece, you know. And there were just bits in there, bits of bodies and, you know, heads and torsos. And I just found myself clutching my armpits and sweating. And I had to leave. I had to just leave. And so I kind of failed to do that. But then I did do drawings of even the insects and the flowers and the people and, you know.
Did this kind of experience had any impact on your style later on? Or nothing have changed really?
Well, it made me realize really what war is like. It made me realize, you know, and when Tony Blair or John Bush say, yeah, we're going to go and shoot up Iraq, you know, and no one wants them to do it. And the whole, so many people in Britain marched against, you know, the war, and this war that was, we went to war there on the wrong idea. There were no weapons of mass destruction there, as they called them. There was no 40 minutes. We were told 40 minutes and Saddam was saying could wipe us out, you know. All lies, all lies. and just to get us to go to war. And so when I come into those situations now, and I think of those young guys of 19, you know, they're in the army. It's always these young guys that are sent out there. There are some older soldiers, professional soldiers, who, you know, they don't know what they're doing, but they are more organized, or they're professionals.
They're professionals.
Yeah.
So no impact on, you know, your future?
Well, not in what way do impact? It impacted me as much as I know now what war looks like.
I'm trying to, you know, get to the point where you got yourself together with Pink Floyd, because I know Roger Waters has that kind of, probably the same feeling about war. So how did you two get together?
Well, you're right. He is political in that way, and he's anti-war, like I guess we all sensible people are. I made a little film for the BBC called Long Drawn Out Trip, which was a sort of psychedelic stream of consciousness about America at the time. Everything in America I could think of, like Playboy magazine, Walt Disney, Mickey Mouse, Statue of Liberty, Black Power, you know, the astronauts on the moon, all of these things are a long stream of things. And apparently the two of the Pink Floyd members saw it. And one rang up the other and said, "We've got to have this guy work with us. He's fucking mad." I know you're not going to say fucking mad, I know, but
that we'll was do the, something about it.
So that was the reason they brought me in. And then I just started working with them. But yeah, you're right. Roger is political. And the story of the wall is about the wall we all build within ourselves to protect our vulnerability against those who can hurt us. And in Roger's case, originally, it was about his mother. He grew up with his father was killed in the war. He grew up with his mother. His girlfriend hurt him. His teacher at home, his teacher at school scorned him in front of other people. So all of these people were able to get to the bit that really hurt. And his theory was and is that to protect our vulnerability, we put up a strong shield into ourselves, a wall against those who can hit us. And that, in turn, walls us up, spoils our sensitivity, spoils our ability to feel, because we're trying to, you know, immure ourselves from the pain out there. So it all started like that in a very personal way. But then since then, Roger has now developed the show, and it more is now in a universal, general sort of way about the way, you know, the actual walls that we've had, like the Berlin Wall, right, and the walls that have been all built all around the world to shut people out, keep people in. And you people here know well about it. And it's more of a universal theme now. But I think the reason, going back to your original question, he wanted to work with me is because I was political, had a name for being extremely political in a general sense, you know, a worldwide sense, and that he wanted to... I'm what he calls his co-author. He wrote the lyrics and the music, and I did the pictures, you know, and so I've given a vision to his ideas.
I was just wondering how it is like when two or maybe three megalomaniacs are closed in one room and they have to work together.
Well, you can see the result, really, in the film, I guess. I mean,
the result was brilliant, but
well,
was it without
it was very,
fights? Or?
It was very full of angst. Roger and I originally were working on the show together, and when it came to the time to make a film, we brought in Alan Parker. Alan Parker, like all directors, naturally wants to direct. He wants to be in charge. He wants to be the top guy. Roger and I had been working on it a long time, and we weren't going to release our territory. Roger wanted to hold on to what he had, and I definitely wanted to hold on to my animation. I didn't want it changed. I didn't want this. So, you know, we had to fight for our territory. And that's where the saying came from. You know, if you put these three guys, who are all used to getting their own way, you put those three megalomaniacs in a room, what do you expect, you know? And, you know, the extraordinary thing is that people get something out of this film. There's a Gulf War veteran emailed me the other day, and he wanted my signature because he'd covered the whole of his arm in my drawings from Pink Floyd.
Oh, did he?
Tattooed, you know, tattooed arm. and he wanted my signature so he could sign his arm. And then after that, he sent me the video of him being tattooed with the name onto his arm. And during the whole of the tattooing, he was talking to me.
Hmm.
And he told me that when he was in the Gulf War, he looks about kind of 50s, in that kind of era. When he was in the Gulf War, my drawings saved him. Now, God knows how they saved him, because there's something dark. And he said, you know, that he wanted to thank me and that this, that, and the other, and that he wanted to send me his medal, his Gulf War medal, which he did. I mean, I sent it back because I said, you know, you're the hero, not me. I'm just an artist. You know, you. I think he was slightly offended that I sent the medal back, but it amazes me that there is that strength, that music and art and vision can affect people that much, you know, that they can really alter their lives because of it.
Hmm. This is a very strong story. What is more for you? Is it this fact, you know, that, you know, your paintings, your drawings saved his life, or that's what he thinks, or public recognitions because you are well-known artist?
Well, public recognition after a while means nothing, you know. It doesn't. I'm not that I'm not recognized in public because my work is what represents me. You know, if you're an actor or something, then it's your face. But the recognition itself is at my point in life. You know, is that it doesn't. When you're young, you're trying, you know, to get recognized, to be famous or whatever it is. But then after a while, it just becomes the way it is rather than something that you desire. I'm still really, I think, trying to, you know, to put down my thoughts clearly on paper in the form of drawing, and I don't always succeed. I mean, working in a newspaper, you're up against a deadline all the time, and sometimes just as the deadline arrives, I have a better idea, or I don't like the drawing I've done, but, you know, tough, it has to go. And so much of my work is out there that I don't really like.
But I think you certainly did succeed, and I hope everything will work for you in the future. And I hope our listeners will like your exhibition, which you had finally at Kampa Museum at Prague. So thank you very much, Mr. Skopp,
for
the interview.
Well, I do hope they come, because I'd like them to see the drawings. You know, I like to have a public there. And thank you very much. That was a really good, very nice, comfortable interview.
You're
one of the best.
Thank you.